I'm going to turn now to some questions from you. The first one, what would you consider a viable alternative to the current Palestinian situation? Would the current occupied territory serve as an adequate sovereign state with a government independent from Jewish influence? Professor Pearl, can we start with you? All right, Mr. Pearl. You want to join the university?
Well, I don't... I'm a lot less enthusiastic about that than I was an hour ago. I don't have an answer. And I think I probably differ from Professor Chomsky, who has an answer for absolutely everything. And we'll tell it to you at great length.
All right. What about the Palestinian situation?
I really don't have a solution except to say that a precondition for any solution must be a recognition on the part of all parties of the legitimacy of all parties. That is, you cannot build a political agreement on the premise that a Jewish state in Palestine is illegitimate. It isn't going to happen. And if it did happen, it would not be stable or secure. So that seems to me the necessary first step. Professor Chomsky has all but acknowledged that he too thinks that the PLO ought to recognize the right of Israel to exist as an independent Jewish state in Palestine, and I hope he has more influence with them than he's likely to have with the makers of American foreign policy.
What about the, Professor Chomsky, what about the, what would you consider a viable alternative to the current Palestinian situation?
Well, there's an obvious viable alternative, and the international consensus that I described has in fact outlined it. Europe, most of Europe, most of the aligned countries, the major Arab states, the mainstream of the PLO for well over a decade, have called for a two-state political settlement with arrived at by negotiations leading to mutual recognition. PLO doesn't have to wait for my advice, which I wouldn't give them anyway, to call for mutual recognition of Israel and a new Palestine state. They've been calling for that for years. Now, if you listen to Mr. Pearl carefully, you'll notice that a word was sneaked in there. That was the word recognition of their legitimacy. Now, that they will not do. And notice that there is, there's an interesting diplomatic history with regard to the Middle East. The United States has been trying to block a settlement for a long time. After it became obvious that the PLO and the Arab states were quite willing to accept the existence of Israel, that is, to achieve a two-state settlement with recognized borders, with international guarantees, with mutual recognition, and so on, after it became obvious that this was possible, it was necessary to up the ante a notch. And what happened was, and here you take a look at recent American diplomatic history. Again, I urge you to look at the documents, very informative. You'll notice that position was changed. It was not enough for them to recognize Israel. They had to recognize the legitimacy of Israel, or the right to exist of Israel. Now, right to exist is something that doesn't exist in international law. No state recognizes the right of any other state to exist. Mexico does not recognize
most
the right of the United States.
Most states don't question the rights of other states.
That's not true. We reject outright the right of the Soviet Union
to
exist in its present borders. That's why we have a Captive Nations Week every year. Mexico does not, and we may be perfectly right in doing that, Mexico does not recognize the right of the United States to exist within its present borders, which happen to include a third of Mexico. In fact, in the international system, there is a notion of recognition of a state, but there is no notion of recognition of the legitimacy of a state. To call on the Palestinians to accept this new concept is to ask them to accept the not only that there's a state in an area which they regard as their home, they're willing to recognize that, but to recognize the right of that state to have dispossessed them. Now, of course, they're not going to accept that, nor should they. There is no such thing in international affairs, and the effort to try to obtain it is pointless and absurd. So let me now make clear that while the PLO has, with varying degrees of ambiguity, but often with great precision, I should say, called for a political settlement with along the lines I mentioned, Israel and the United States have been equally clear, namely in rejecting any such political settlement. The United States and Israel reject any, not only do they reject the right of the Palestinians to self-determination, they reject any manifestation of that right. In fact, U.S.-Israeli rejectionism is so extreme that the United States and Israel will not even permit the Palestinians to select their own representatives for eventual negotiations. That's really extreme. If somebody had come along in 1947 and said the Jews in Palestine can be represented, but not by the Zionists, we would have called that a regression to Nazism, correctly, and the same principle holds here. The fact that the PLO has engaged in terror, as have all, to my knowledge, other nationalist movements, including George Washington, obviously not to the point. By those standards, we would have rejected the Zionist movement, which engaged in extreme terror. In fact, the current Prime Minister of Israel, Yitzhak Shamir, was the head of one of the leading terrorist groups, the group that assassinated the UN ambassador Pope Bernadotte, among many other atrocities, and was the author in 1947 of a pamphlet in which he not only advocated terror, but said that there is no moral barrier whatsoever to the use of terror, nor can there be. Well, yeah, that's what national movements are like, but that doesn't stop us from dealing with them. And it doesn't stop us, we're like that too. All of these are simply excuses to try to evade the political settlement that has long been possible. That's a political settlement among national groups which exist. One of them has its national existence realized in the state of Israel. The other is under military occupation. If we agree, there's a point of principle here, of course, if we agree that Palestinians have the same human rights as Jews, maybe we don't, but if we agree to that, then there is an obvious form of political settlement, namely the two-state settlement of the sort that we have rejected, that Israel rejects, just as its governing party continues to claim Jordan. Now, I don't think we should back that. I think we should allow a move towards political settlement. It won't be easy. A lot of problems. But at least we can begin to move in that direction.
Let me pick another question. And this one, Mr. Chomsky, we'll start with you. What do you think the U.S. can and should do to help stop drug trade in Latin America?
Well, one thing we can do to stop drug trade is to stop cooperating with it. So, for example, that won't end it. In fact, it will come along, though not come nowhere near ending it, but it'd be a good start. So, for example, take, say, General Noriega. He's been well known to be up to his neck in the drug racket since certainly the early 70s, mid-70s at the latest. And he was a very favored U.S. ally until the mid-1980s, long after that. The reason was because he was performing services for us. He was offering a base for the attack against Nicaragua and so on. He ran a totally fraudulent election in 1984. This guy who's right at the top of the international, of the Colombian drug cartel, we rewarded that by sending George Shultz down to bless the occasion as a great step forward in democracy after the fraudulent election. For reasons that are still not entirely clear, but apparently because Noriega at some point stopped following our orders, we decided to turn against him, and incidentally we've achieved the magnificent result of organizing virtually most of Latin America and even the Catholic Church in Panama in favor of Noriega, who they hate because of the form of U.S. intervention. That's a real achievement. But one thing we could have done is to avoid that form of participation in the drug racket. The same is true of the Contra story. There's very little doubt by now. I mean, I think the evidence is very convincing that the Contra aid program was tied up with drugs. That's not the first time, incidentally. You look at the history of clandestine warfare, and you find that it's very often linked to the drug racket. There's a very simple reason for that. Covered actions, clandestine actions, require untraceable money. And one of the places you go for untraceable money and for thugs and so on and so forth is to the drug racket. That's why the CIA back in the late 1940s, as part of its efforts to break up the French labor unions, reconstituted the Corsican Mafia, apparently offering as a quid pro quo the reconstitution, the rebuilding of the heroin racket. That's why one of the major centers of the drug trade shifted over to the Golden Triangle in Laos, Thailand, Burma, at the time of U.S. clandestine operations there. And that's why the Contra operations are involved in drugs. Now, this is a small part of it. That's not the whole problem. The main source of drugs is coming from elsewhere, but that's a part. So one thing we could do to try to control the drug racket is to stop supporting it. A second thing we can do, and this now becomes more serious, my own view, frankly, is that the only way the drug racket will be controlled is by legalizing it. That's a proposal that's been made repeatedly. I mean, I think we're in a situation, this has to be thought through carefully. It's not a trivial matter. But I think we're in a situation rather like that of prohibition structurally. The drugs are going to come. The drug racket is linked to powerful financial institutions. Ramon Millan Rodriguez, the accountant for the Colombian cartel, testified not long ago before Congress that he had connections with major American banks. He hardly needed his testimony to know this. I mean, this is a major capitalist institution. It's going to work. It's going to work through existing institutions. If it's illegal, it's also going to build up crime, organized crime and terror. Now, I really do not think there's going to be any way to control it. It's too closely interlinked with major centers of finance, capital, power, and so on. And I think the only thing we can do is to decriminalize it and try to reduce it in the manner in which the plague of alcoholism, which of course still exists, was decriminalized, thus reducing the power of the criminal elements while not eliminating alcohol. And I am pretty much convinced that that's the direction we're going to have to go if we want to overcome this plague, and it is a plague.
Mr. Pearl, what can the United States do to stop the drug trade in Latin America?
Frankly, I'm not either expert or particularly interested in that question, so I won't say more than that I think the idea that we should legalize drugs, and we're not talking now about a little pot, we're talking about hard drugs, is on the theory that this will, that because it is so well protected by capitalist interests, if we legalize it, at least there won't be criminals involved, is an absurd notion. We may not be able to stop the flow from Latin America. We can, to some degree, reduce it, which keeps market prices high, and that may be the best we can hope to accomplish.
This next question, let's start with you, Mr. Pearl. You point out that American foreign policy in regards to our NATO allies and Japan was based on the idea of reconstruction and not control. But you fail to take into account the sources of new materials for this reconstruction, namely third world countries, which were directly controlled by the U.S. How, then, can the United States foreign policy be classified as not being one of controlling other countries when this state of affairs exists?
Look, we have no particular interest, despite the fact that Professor Chomsky continues to assert it and obfuscates when pressed to explain himself, in controlling other countries. He makes it sound as though somehow we benefit from control and take such an extreme view of it that we would even, in his theory, knowingly and deliberately drive a country that might otherwise not be aligned with the Soviet Union into the arms of the Soviet Union. It is a bizarre theory of American policy. The fact is that we have no particular interest in controlling countries beyond the United States. We have an interest in protecting our security. We do not want to see, obviously, Soviet military forces in Latin America. We have an interest in working together with our allies to try to protect and maintain a stable military balance. But the notion of control, his image of the post-war reconstruction of Europe, where we are accused of eliminating the anti-fascist resistance, and the buzzwords are starting to come out as this debate continues, in order to facilitate American investment Now, of course, you would have most Europeans accusing us of protectionism and trying to protect our own domestic markets for ourselves. The fact is that we are better off, and it's Professor Chomsky's term, with liberal internationalism, that is, with other countries free and independent and democratic, in a position to interact on a free and independent and voluntary basis with the United States. And the notion that we have anything to gain from control is not only not proven historically, it's rubbish. It's a construct that he builds in order to explain, in order to get at what ultimately is his preference for a different international economic order and a different development model.
Mr. Cameron?
Let me stress again that my preferences are beside the point here. The preference of mine that's relevant in this case is permitting freedom and independence and avoiding forceful intervention of great powers in the interests of their own dominant groups. Now, the question was not reconstruction, but not control. Our policy towards Europe, there's enormous documentation on this now, I should say, was reconstruction with control. So we wanted to reconstruct Europe and Japan, but in a particular fashion. We wanted to reconstruct something like the old order, but now not hostile to us, rather integrated into the grand area. Remember, that's not my term. That's the State Department Council Foreign Relations term that we were trying to develop. Hence, repeatedly, in country after country, we moved to undermine the anti-fascist resistance, which was largely animated by one or another idea of radical democracy or socialism or whatever. Sometimes this was done with extreme violence, as in, say, Greece and South Korea. Other times it was done by subversion, as, say, in France. Sometimes it was done by actual partition. The United States, one of the reasons why the United States was rather favorable to partition of Germany, and indeed may have initiated it, was that it was understood that a unified Germany would have a powerful labor movement. That's discussed carefully, I should say, in internal documents of the period, which have now been declassified. We wanted to reconstruct a particular form of social order in the industrial capitalist countries, one in which liberal internationalism would prevail, guaranteeing our dominance given the balance of power at the time. Mr. Pearl points out that now we're moving towards a degree of protectionism. That's true, because the relative power no longer guarantees our dominance. And here again, I suggest that we look at all of this in a broader historical perspective. It's been absolutely traditional for a couple hundred years since modern industrial capitalism developed. It's been traditional for those who believe they're going to win in the competition to be in favor of free trade. Now, there's even a standard name for this in the scholarly literature. It's called the imperialism of free trade, referring in particular to the British Empire. The British Empire, during the period when Britain was being established as the world's major industrial power, the rape of India and so on, they were not at all in favor of free trade. By the early part of the 19th century, when England became the workplace of the world, the dominant industrial power, it became in favor of free trade on the assumption that its domestic investors and so on would win out in any competition. By about the 1920s, when England was no longer able to compete with Japan, it turned against free trade. In fact, closed off the empire to Japanese penetration. And that's exactly the story that we're reliving. As long as it was assumed that the United States, U.S. interests would effectively win out in any competition, as in fact they did for many decades, we were all in favor of freedom of trade. Now that it's not at all clear that they're going to win out in competition, we naturally turn to some other forms of protectionism, just as we were highly protectionist in the 19th century when we had to develop our own industrial system by blocking British steel imports. Nothing very surprising about this. Perfectly standard. If we didn't have the documentary record which explains it, we would know it anyhow just by looking at the historical record. With regard to the Third World, that meant exactly what was stated. It's got to be available for exploitation for the reconstruction of industrial capitalism in the manner in which we want it reconstructed. That's part of the reason for the continual intervention and violence in the third world, the attacks on democracy, the attacks on freedom, the slaughters, whether it's Indonesia in 1965 or Central America today, the repeated interventions in places like Guatemala. That's the reason for it. It's a way to maintain a certain kind of world order, a world order in which U.S.-based interests will, in fact, prosper. That's been the purpose. It's not terribly surprising.
Let me sue that, Professor Chomsky, with this question. Your summary of U.S. foreign policy in the post-war period implies a level of rationality, efficiency, and unswerving purpose at variance with the widespread perceptions of that policy, which frequently seems irrational, ineffective, and oscillating in character. What group do you see as driving force behind this policy, and how has it been so singularly effective in pushing its program?
Well, we can identify exactly who was involved. I mean, in fact, in the 1940s and the early 50s, there was quite sophisticated planning, I should say. This was a period of considerable intelligence. If you read the documentary record, you see thoughtful, careful planning of a kind which I've sampled. Now, it's not that they didn't make mistakes. You know, the world's a complicated place, and there were many mistakes. But it was largely successful in the interests that they attempted to achieve, the interests that I've described. As to identifying the people involved, that's easy. You can even find their names. You know, more interesting than their names is the institutions they represented. Overwhelmingly, they're drawn from a small number of corporations, investment firms, half a dozen law firms that represent primarily corporate interests, people who had a broad picture of the needs of U.S.-based corporations, which, of course, dominate the state system, not surprisingly. That's the interest they represented. That's the world they organized. Now, you can say you like the world or you can say you hate it, but that's the world they organized with considerable thoughtfulness and, in fact, a lot of success. Now, since that period, it's been mostly a matter of following out the lines of policy that were already established. So, for example, in the case of Southeast Asia, we happen to have a very rich documentary record, reaching, in fact, way beyond the officially declassified materials because of the opening up of the Southeast Asia files after the Pentagon Papers affair. And what you see there, if you look, is simply the application of principles already established to this specific case, with very little innovative thinking, I should say. Today, we don't know what the planning is because we don't have the documents available, but you can make it out. You can make it out by watching the events unfold. The United States, since the economic damage caused to the United States by the Vietnam War, they didn't know that that was going to be so costly. Since that time, the U.S. economy has been in trouble. It's been necessary to expand the role of the state in protecting the relatively competitive sectors of the U.S. economy. We are moving towards a kind of protectionism. The major protectionism in the United States, in fact, is the support for high technology industry. We in the United States have a system of a state protected market, state guaranteed market for high technology production, a system for forcing a public subsidy to high technology production, in particular the costly research and development aspect of high technology production. That's called the Pentagon. It's not just for producing weapons. So take a look at the history of the computer industry. You'll discover that in the 1950s, the core of any modern industrial society, you look in the 1950s when computers were not marketable, really. The support for research and development of computers was 100% of the military system. By the 1960s, computers became sellable on the market. So that support by the state, you know, forced subsidy through the state, reduced to approximately 50%. Now we're engaged in the development of what's called fifth-generation computers, big, huge computer development competing with Japan and so on. The state contribution shot up again. It's now approximately 100% for research and development through the Pentagon, NASA, which is just the front for the Pentagon, and the Department of Energy, which is primarily using them for the production of nuclear weapons. That's the system that we use to create a protected market for the parts of the economy that still function. And under the Reagan administration, which in fact is highly protectionist and highly committed to state intervention, this system expanded radically. That's our system of, called military Keynesianism, of developing, protecting the parts of the economy that in fact function. It's a costly system. The Reaganite economic management, which was particularly disastrous, had the effects of, turning the United States into a tremendous debtor country after having been the world's major creditor, of seriously affecting the trade balance and so on, and those are costs that we'll have to bear. But that's what comes from this kind of protectionism. I mean, particularly in the Reagan administration, we've succeeded in combining some of the worst features of state-run economies, inefficiencies and so on, with some of the worst features of private capitalism. It's a real achievement.
Mr. Pearl, there's an economic power elite which provides the consistency in American foreign policy. Your response?
Well, of course, it is a lot more complicated than Professor Chomsky thinks it is. The making of American foreign policy is subject to a great many influences other than the room full of capitalist lawyers, bankers, and corporate executives that he conjures up, who in his view of the world have since 1945 been manipulating American policy in order to serve their own selfish financial interests. It's a simple enough model. It's a model that is intended to appeal. He keeps referring to the documents that prove it. He keeps coming back to the Policy Planning Council at the Department of State. I've served in government for a good many years now, and I've never yet seen a Policy Planning Council document that interested anyone except the authors of the Policy Planning Council. And anyone who thinks that American policy is based on the implementation of Policy Planning Council documents has never had the experience of either seeing one of those documents or grappling with the problem of implementing American foreign policy. There is no power elite of the kind that Professor Chomsky suggests there is, manipulating the world in the interests of American capitalism. You're perfectly free to accept that model if you like, but no one who's had any association with the policy process would believe it for a minute.
Do you have an alternative notion of the policy process?
Well, as the question implied, there is a great deal of that goes into the making of policy that includes things like imperfect knowledge and not necessarily understanding the social and political forces with which we're dealing. There are mistakes, to be sure. There's a lot of idealism in the process. People who believe that the United States ought to make sacrifices of various kinds in order to assist in the expansion of democracy around the world, and we've gotten ourselves into some trouble from time to time in an effort to accomplish that. But if you listen to Mr. Chomsky, you think that we are motivated entirely by a kind of rapacious elite looking after their own interests, and it's complete nonsense, of course.
A question we'll start with you, Mr. Pearl, about terrorism. And what is terrorism? Does 170-plus dead Palestinians killed by settlers and Zionist troops qualify as terrorism? How about 700-plus dead South African youth in 1976 in South Africa? Is this terrorism? Does 40,000 dead Nicaraguans qualify as terrorism? If not, please explain.
Is that that applause, I take it, is for the question and not for my answer? Let me say this. Whatever terrorism is, I would not define it in such a manner as to confuse acts by the PLO against non-combatants, frequently children, with action taken by George Washington in the American War of Independence. Now, it does seem to me that the essence of the concept of terrorism is an attack against non-combatants, that is, an attack against people who are not involved, not directly parties to a conflict. And one of the things that I object to in the analogy suggested by Professor Chomsky is the failure to recognize that when the PLO attacks a bus full of civilians, including children, and murders them, that is not in any way to be compared with a struggle for independence.
Okay.
May I comment on that one?
Well, I've given a definition of terrorism. You can apply it to those situations.
Sure. I think that here again I'll unfortunately refer to U.S. documents, which I think are quite good. The U.S. Code has an official definition of terrorism. I think it's a pretty good one. State Department and Army documents, for example, the Army Manual Countering Terrorism, have good definitions of terrorism. I think we ought to keep to it. Basically, without quoting all the words, it comes down to just what you said. The threat or use of force to coerce and intimidate civilian populations. That's terrorism. Now, that would include, in fact, George Washington's actions, for example, perhaps went beyond terrorism, like the destruction of the Iroquois civilization in 1779, the rampaging of Green's armies, and so on. I don't say that particularly critically. I really don't know of any national movement that didn't involve terrorism. But let's keep up until today. I agree with you that when the PLO attacks civilians, that's terrorism. Similarly, when the United States directs its proxy army, as it's called in internal documents again, when it directs its proxy army to attack soft targets, the words of General John Galvin testifying to Congress a year or two ago, to attack soft targets and not to, going on, to duke it out with the Sandinistas directly, that is to avoid defended targets and attack soft targets, that's terrorism. When Charles Redman of the State Department spokesman endorses publicly the attack of our proxy forces against agricultural collectives on the grounds that there are some people with arms defending them, that's advocacy of terrorism, just as it would be if Gaddafi endorsed the attack of the attacks by the PLO against Israeli collectives, which are far better armed than the cooperatives that we're attacking. All that's terrorism. When former CIA Director Stansfield Turner testified before Congress in 1985 on this, he simply referred to our attack against Nicaragua as terrorism, state-sponsored terrorism. That's giving us the benefit of the doubt, I should say. If you take the World Court decision seriously, it may pass beyond terrorism to the much more serious crime of aggression, unlawful use of force. But giving the U.S. the benefit of the doubt, it's large-scale terrorism. When the PLO attacks a bus and kills civilians, that's terrorism. When Israel bombs civilian targets in the Bekaa Valley, killing with hundreds of maybe 400 casualties, including children killed in a bombed-out schoolhouse, mosques destroyed, markets destroyed, and so on, that's terrorism. In fact, there's plenty of terrorism in the world. By and large, it's a roughly fair generalization that the more powerful the entity involved, the more terrorism it carries out. There are exceptions, but there's no doubt that we're doing quite well in that conflict. I might point out that we're one of the few countries in the world that's officially committed to terrorism. There are other terrorist states, but I want to stress that the United States has an official commitment to terrorism. The attack against the commitment to attack soft targets, such as agricultural cooperatives, that's an official commitment to terrorism. In fact, if you take a look at the U.S. Army published manuals on low-intensity conflict, the policy we're officially committed to, you will notice that the definition of low-intensity conflict happens to be almost word for word the definition of terrorism. The use of measures short of aggression to coerce and intimidate the population. That's low-intensity conflict. Take a look at the definitions. This it's not that we're the only terrorist state, but we're ranked rather high in the competition for major terrorist power.
Mr. Pearl?
I don't have anything to add to that.
A question, let's start with you, Professor Chomsky. The Nicaraguan government official who recently defected has stated that regardless of peace efforts, the Nicaraguan government will pursue a policy of military expansion with the Soviet Union. Why or why shouldn't we believe their claims that this is to be a defensive force?
Well, he's speaking of Colonel Miranda, who did not state, read the documents that he produced, he did not state or in any way imply that Nicaragua was intending, regardless of peace, to carry out a policy of military expansion with the Soviet Union. What Miranda stated, true or false, was the following. In fact, the only newsworthy and, in fact, novel statement that he produced was that the United States had been vastly exaggerating the number of Cuban and Soviet advisors in Nicaragua, which is much lower than what the United States had claimed, according to him, and approximately what Nicaragua had stated. He said that if in the coming years, if the Contra war declines, Nicaragua would reduce the size of its military forces. That was what he stated. It would reduce the size of its military forces, and it would provide light arms to the civilian population to defend the country against the threat, which continues and is constantly raised, the threat of a possible U.S. Military invasion. That means they would try to turn the country into something roughly like Israel, a nation under arms, but of course at a much lower level of military armament. He stated that Nicaragua was the only place where the Soviet Union came into this. He stated that Nicaragua intended to obtain MiG aircraft, jet interceptors. However, he did not state, and you can easily discover if you want, that Nicaragua would be delighted to obtain French Mirage interceptors. They've repeatedly said that. They don't care whether the interceptors they get come from France or the Soviet Union. They'd, in fact, prefer to get them from France because that would terminate the propaganda about their being a client of the Soviet Union. So the fact is they want jet interceptors. Since we've blocked our allies from sending them to them, they're going to turn to the Soviet Union. Why do they need jet interceptors? Well, because at that time, for all we know today, but certainly at that time, the CIA was flying planes into Nicaragua at the level of 2 to 3 a day to provide supplies for the terrorist forces that we have, what we had established in the country. That's an enormous supply effort. It was combined with an enormous surveillance effort to provide the Contras with information in real time, sophisticated communication equipment, to provide them with information in real time about the deployment of Sandinista forces so they could proceed to attack soft targets in accord with our directives. And it's well known that the only way that they can try to protect their territory against constant military intrusion by the United States is with jet interceptors. There's no other way to do it. Yes, they're trying to defend their territory. That's essentially the gist of the Miranda exposures. It's kind of interesting that the United States regarded that as scandalous. See, we regard it as scandalous for any country to be able to defend themselves against our attack. If any country tries to obtain planes from France or anyone else to defend itself against our attack, that's a scandal. We've got to destroy them. How can we tolerate this threat to our existence? Let me suggest a question to you. Take the way we talk about this Miranda exposure and about Nicaragua in general, and let's try the following thought experiment. Suppose that there was a debate going on in the Soviet Union about Luxembourg, in which they said, look, Luxembourg is an advanced industrial power, linked to the United States, part of a hostile military alliance, Denmark even worse, planes and so on and so forth, tremendous threat to Soviet security. Obviously, we've got to organize a terrorist force to undermine them, maybe, in fact, given the scale of the threat they pose as compared with the threat Nicaragua poses to us, maybe we would actually, you know, nuke them or something like that. Suppose it went on to say, well, look, if Luxembourg or Denmark obtain jet planes, well, then obviously we got to bomb them into the sea. How can we tolerate that kind of threat? If a discussion like that were going on in the Soviet Union, how would we react, as far as I know, non-existent Soviet discussion, and see what conclusions you draw about our own political culture from that?
Mr. Pearl, what about, shouldn't we believe a defecting Nicaraguan official about their intentions to follow a policy of military expansion with the Soviet Union?
Yes.
Okay. Let me ask each of you to make a brief comment about one concluding question, and then I'll ask for final summary statements. And the final question that I would put to each of you is, pick either either area that we've talked about, either Nicaragua or in Central America or the Middle East, and say in a few sentences what the United States foreign policy in that area should be now. What would you propose? Mr. Pearl, may we start with you?
Well, I happen to think that, broadly speaking, American policy in the Middle East has been aimed and continues to be aimed at trying to help bring about a settlement of the principal disputes that plague that part of the world, in particular the dispute between Israel and some of its Arab neighbors and the PLO. But I think we have chosen the right basis upon which to attempt to do that, which is a change of a fundamental nature in the threat that an irredentist PLO committed to the destruction of Israel would pose. Professor Chomsky says it isn't an issue of security. It is very much an issue of security. It's all very well to sit in Columbus, Ohio, and say it's not an issue of security. But there have been a number of wars already in the Middle East, each one of which potentially threatened the survival of the Jewish population in the state of Israel. And I think the Israelis have a right to insist on security arrangements that have some hope and some promise of stability, and the United States has by and large been right in supporting those same objectives. It is more than a trivial matter when one talks about the legitimacy of one's right to exist, because as Professor Chomsky knows full well, until the legitimacy of that right to exist is acknowledged, any settlement, any political or territorial settlement, will at best be a temporary settlement in the context of the larger effort to destroy the very existence of a Jewish state in Palestine. And I think the United States is quite right enough to align itself with pressures to that end.
Thank you. After Mr. Chomsky responds, I'm going to ask you to make the opening, concluding remark in about 5 minutes.
Well, that should be sometime around breakfast.
Okay.
By my reckoning.
I'll try to make it in time for a midnight snack.
Briefly, Professor Chomsky.
Thank you. Let me talk about Israeli security, which I think we should be concerned about. Let me repeat that the comments on Israeli security that I was referring to were not my judgments. They were the judgments of expressed in the cabinet meetings and other planning sessions that have been amply documented in the scholarly literature in Israel in Hebrew. For they did not see the issue of security, and rightly so. Because as former head of military intelligence General Harkabi and others will explain to you and do explain to you, the problem of a Palestinian state is not one of security. A demilitarized Palestinian state, which is what it will be, contained in a hostile Jordanian-Israeli military alliance, will undoubtedly improve the security of Israel. But that's not the whole point. In my view, here we probably do differ. It's not just the security of Israel that's at stake. Peace in that region will improve the security of Israel. I think that's pretty likely. And steps towards peace would be a step towards Israeli security. But that's not the only issue. There happen to be Palestinians there. There's an indigenous population. And their security counts every bit as much as the security of the Jewish population. So, all of this talk about you're sitting here and not talking about them, if I were to resort to the same rhetorical technique, I would say, I do not do this, this is conditional, I would say, well, it's very nice to sit here and talk about the security of the Palestinians in refugee camps. That's not the point. We should be concerned with the security of the Israelis and of the Palestinians, and I think there's an obvious way to maximize, not, of course, guarantee that security. With regard to the question of legitimacy, if the failure to recognize the legitimacy of Israel, this new concept in international affairs, if that excludes the PLO, then plainly Israel's excluded from the negotiations as well, because it not only refuses to accept the legitimacy of Palestinian nationalism, it even refuses the lower demand, much lower one, of accepting the request of the PLO for negotiations leading to mutual recognition. In fact, it refuses even to allow the Palestinians to accept to choose their own representatives for eventual negotiations. And it is not only putting these forth as statements, it is acting to implement them. Finally, last comment. Even if we were to accept this innovation in international affairs and demand that the Palestinians not only recognize Israel, which they've already stated long ago they're willing to do, but recognize the legitimacy of their dispossession from their homes, even if we impose this extra and novel burden on them, can anyone seriously believe that such a statement, such a verbal statement, would improve the security of Israel? That's living in a dream world. Security is not based on verbal statements made by some leader under duress. Security is based on arrangements that are created among states and other groups, not on some empty verbiage. Even if they were to produce this statement, it would not contribute one iota to the security of Israel, a fact that's obvious, and it tells us exactly what the point of those demands is. The point of those demands is to place further roadblocks in the way of a political settlement.
Now for the 5-minute concluding statements, we'll start with Mr. Richard Pearl. The podium is yours.
I have sat this evening and listened at, I think, probably greater length than I would have desired, to a vision of a world that I have never seen in my years in government, to the vision of a world in which a small number of men foolishly, in order to enrich themselves, are prepared to inflict suffering and cruelty throughout the world. This is not a policy that I recognize. I trust that for most of you it's not a policy that you recognize. I have heard it said that the National Aeronautics and Space Administration is a front for the Pentagon, that the United States has committed atrocities comparable to Pol Pot, that Europe is a quasi-democratic order, that the reconstruction of the post-war world was done for the convenience and the benefit of a few self-interested men who cared nothing about values, nothing about democratic institutions, nothing about the well-being of anyone beyond themselves. I've even heard it said that when the U.S. managed to assist in an agreement between Egypt and Israel that followed 3 wars and much destruction between those two countries, that that was intended to assist Israel to retain a military occupation. It's a deeply cynical view of the world, a view said to derive from documents, but I must say to you, from a profound misreading of documents. It is a view that recognizes no decency in the making of American policy or its implementation. It is hardly in the interests of enlightenment on this occasion to go through refuting point by point the documents I've not seen. That seems to me quite beside the point. You know from your own experience, you know from your own observations, what the people of this country represent, and by and large, although mistakes get made from time to time, and in any human organization mistakes will be made, I think you know and understand what the American people represent and what their elected leaders represent. They do not represent what Professor Chomsky says they represent. And if you believe that that is what this country is all about, if you believe that we are organized principally to serve the selfish interests of a few, and that the historical experience of this country since the war has been dedicated and devoted to that, then I think you will have a lot of difficulty explaining the enormous prosperity, the benefits of democracy that this country has managed to bring to much of the world. And I ask you, as you depart this evening, to consider whether the world you've heard described tonight by Professor Chomsky, there is any relationship to the world in which you live and make observations of your own. Thank you.
And now for the 5-minute concluding statement from Professor Noam Chomsky.
Well, I finally found something that Mr. Pearl said that I agreed with. Our discussion so far has been relatively, at least, cool and abstract and antiseptic. We have not looked into the eyes of the victims, as is often the case, the terrorized peasants, the slum dwellers of El Salvador. They've been remote from our consciousness. The maimed victims of the forces we send out to attack soft targets in Nicaragua, the children with broken limbs in a Gaza hospital, a peasant woman trying to cook in the rain in the ruins of her home demolished in collective punishment in what Israel, with our aid, is turning into a vast concentration camp. Having just returned from the West Bank and shortly before from Central America, these images do happen to be vivid in my mind. I haven't talked about them. I'd like to use these last few moments just to outline the radical shift in policy that I think American citizens should induce our government to undertake, and we have ways to do it. With regard to Nicaragua, I think we should follow the advice of the leading democratic figure in Central America, José Figueres, who was the founder of Costa Rican democracy. He returned recently from a trip to Nicaragua, which he described as an invaded country, and he called upon the United States to allow the Sandinistas to finish what they started in peace. They deserve it. For the first time, he said, Nicaragua has a government that cares for its people, one that was elected as freely as anyone else in Central America except for Costa Rica. He found a surprising amount of support for the government, he said, despite the destruction of the economy caused by U.S. terror and economic warfare. As is understood throughout the world, this is the reason why the United States government has been unable to convert its proxy army into a guerrilla force, despite the unprecedented support lavished upon them, vastly beyond anything available to authentic popular or guerrilla movements. We should put aside our reliance on violence and our defiance of international law. We should terminate our dedicated efforts to block a peaceful settlement in Central America. We should offer large-scale reparations for recovery from the destruction for which we are responsible. With regard to El Salvador, we should listen to the Archbishop, who calls upon the government we established to accept the offer for negotiations on the part of the indigenous guerrilla forces and to halt what he calls the escalating terror of the death squads, as he now does. We should heed the church-based human rights organization that denounces the continuing state terror and describes Salvadoran society as, I'm quoting, affected by terror and panic, a result of the persistent violation of basic human rights, a society living under collective intimidation and generalized fear that accepts the frequent appearance of tortured bodies because basic rights, the right to life, has absolutely no overriding value for society. We should attend to the recent polls taken by the Jesuit University of San Salvador, which show that 95% of the population prefer economic and humanitarian aid over military aid of any kind, and that 75% oppose both of the political parties that are permitted to function under U.S.-backed state terror called your democracy. The same is true with regard to Guatemala and Honduras, which, like El Salvador, remain under effective military rule behind a thin civilian facade which is erected primarily to extort money from Congress for the benefit of the wealthy and the privileged. In the Middle East, we should reverse our policy of unswerving rejectionism. We should join the very broad international consensus favoring a political settlement with a Palestinian state on the West Bank and Gaza within a regional settlement, with the Palestinians permitted to select their own representatives for negotiations. That means the PLO, which has every bit as much legitimacy as the Zionist organization did in 1947. More generally, we should have the courage and the honesty to face some truths about ourselves and what we do in the world, even if those are unpleasant truths. We should ask why the United States rejects the World Court decision calling on it to refrain from the unlawful use of force against Nicaragua. Why we veto resolutions at the United Nations Security Council calling on all states to observe international law. And why we repeatedly stand alone, or almost alone, in the General Assembly on issues of peace, disarmament, and observance of law. We should ask why we have consistently sought to remove conflicts from the arena of politics and diplomacy to the arena of violence, where we can hope to prevail. We should ponder the meaning of the fact that, as studies have repeatedly shown, U.S. foreign aid correlates closely with torture and egregious human rights violations, and not with need, that it has been used for a form of development that leaves the majority of the population in greater misery and destitution. We might even consider the advice offered over 20 years ago by Marine Commandant David Shoup, who said with regard to Vietnam that the best contribution we can make to its people is to get our bloody dollar crooked hands out of their affairs. And if we can achieve this much, we should consider how we might begin to play a constructive role in the lives of miserable and suffering people throughout the world, instead of treating them as instruments to serve our purposes, or more accurately, the purposes of those elite groups that shape U.S. policies in their interests, not yours or mine. We should consider how the fear of the Soviet Union has been exploited to gain support for intervention and terror, just as fear of the United States has been exploited to similar ends by our global adversary. And we should ask what we can do to reverse this system of tacit cooperation and global oppression. We should begin to raise some fundamental questions about ourselves and our institutions, and ask how they can change so they can become responsive to our true interests, which are not different from those who suffer at our hands. By world standards, we happen to be very free of state and other coercion, and that means that we have means available to learn about ourselves and to act to reverse a course that has brought us shame and has plunged many others into misery. We cannot appeal to fear of repression if we fail to undertake such efforts, but only to selfishness and cowardice. More than any other power, we have the resources to contribute to freedom, human rights, and social and economic development, just as we have the power to destroy and oppress, which is just what the United States government will continue to do if its citizens choose the easy path of obedience and apathy. Ample opportunities are open to us. Our willingness to make use of them will determine the fate of many millions of suffering people in the world, ultimately our own as well.
Thank you. I think it's important to ask a question at this point in our evening together as to what the purpose of dialogue is in the academy. And perhaps the important thing to bear in mind is to be clear what it's not. We in the American society are accustomed to sport events where we go and root for our favored side. Watch the boxer lay a glove on his opponent. Certainly that cannot be the purpose of dialogue and debate in the academy. Instead, our commitment is to invite thoughtful people to lay bare for us alternative visions of our world and how we relate to it. And then, with that sharpened relief, to engage in a thought process ourselves as to indeed the kind of role we wish to play. I think it's noteworthy to observe that both of our speakers urged us tonight to observe the world, to go out and find out for ourselves how it is, and to check what we see with our own preliminary judgments. So, in the spirit of contributing to that exercise, I want to thank both of our speakers, Mr. Richard Pearl, Professor Noam Chomsky, for being with us tonight. And on behalf of the Skuler Ries Lecture Committee and our student co-sponsors, good night.